This is going to be a little bit longer of a talk than usual, so I need your stamina and engagement. Be strong for me. I gave this talk, a version of it, at Socialism Conference, and for technical difficulties, it could not get uploaded to wearemany.org. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to record it anew and send that in. So thank you for bearing with. And so without further ado, socialism and queer liberation. LGBTQ rights have only ever been won through struggle. Many of us are familiar with the queer liberation narrative that starts with Stonewall in 1969 and ends with marriage equality in 2015. There is a great deal of militant history before and after that period, however. In every wave of struggle around sexual and gender liberation, there have been radicals and leftists involved who made the movement more militant and more revolutionary in its ideologies and tactics. In this talk, I will tell some of these militants' stories across the decades. After that history, I'll talk about how socialists can take lessons from this history for our movements today. Queer liberation did not begin and end with Stonewall. There is a vibrant, compelling, and complex history from the mid-20th century forward. These historical struggles were brilliant and brave. However, LGBTQ liberation organizations have also struggled historically over ideology and tactics and politics in ways in which they have posed reform against revolution, culture against politics, and liberty and sexual expression against equality, identity politics against solidarity. These tensions, along with economic decline, right-wing backlash, and the capturing of queer politics by an opportunistic Democratic Party, undermine movements developing militant tactics to win significant change. We can learn from these movements about how to rebuild revolutionary queer liberation struggles. I should say something about language in this talk. Generally, I will employ identity labels in place at the time of events. For example, homosexual gives way to gay, then gay and lesbian, then GLBT, then LGBTQIA, and queer. The language used to describe trans people across some of this history evolved from the word transvestite to transgender, and includes people who identify as drag queens. And I kind of regret that my talk does not contain a huge section on transgender liberation. At Socialism, Katie and Fainan gave an incredible talk specifically on that subject, and it's up at wearemany.org, although I have also included some material from Stryker's history of the trans struggle. So let me just say something about that for a minute, that Susan Stryker's book Transgender History situates trans lives and oppression in the context of intersectional movements working for change since the middle of the 19th century's criminalization of cross-dressing, a movement that, according to gay historian John D'Amelio, significantly predates other queer liberation movements. The modern trans liberation movement begins in about the same time period as other queer liberation struggles, which is in the early 1950s, and organizations that organize social events and support for criminalized trans people. So just backing up and giving a little bit of background to the queer liberation struggle that begins in the 1950s, the industrial era brought gays and lesbians together as city streets opened narrowly to gay society. Culture, community, places like bars and bathhouses, and Haptip, the village people, the YMCA. Paradoxically, prohibition and the underground mafia-led bar scene made socializing easier underground. The Second World War brought men and women together in sex-segregated environments as never before. However, homosexuality was widely regarded as a sin, a derangement, or a crime, or all of the above, and queers lived lives of isolation, secrecy, and persecution. Enter into this picture the homophile movement. This movement was sparked by the experience of oppression, but also by the Kinsey Report on male sexuality and also Donald Corey's book, Homosexual in America, texts that challenged medical and pathological models of homosexuality. In the 1930s and 1940s, Harry Hay was a member of the Communist Party. He remained active in the LGBTQ struggle throughout the mid-century, all the while trying to win people to class analyses of oppression. He argued that the revolutionary tenets of communism could be applied to homosexuals insofar as gays and lesbians could be regarded as an oppressed minority struggling for self-determination. Hay famously attended a Halloween costume party dressed as the demise of fascism. I have not been able to find a picture of that costume, but it gives me some ideas for Halloween this year. Sharing the experience of oppression was a source of identity, culture, and politics. Hay noted, and I quote, "We were in love with each other and each other's ideas." Eisenhower's 1953 executive order barred sexual perverts from federal employment, and thousands were fired in shame. During the simultaneous Red and Lavender Scares, in which homosexuals were persecuted as potential communists and or security risks, Hay argued for militancy and radicalism. Thus, the homophile movement, which begins with Hay and the Mattachine Society, was not the bastion of conservatism that we are often told that it was. Mattachine was a secret homosocial organization for men that began in 1951 in Los Angeles. The name Mattachine, according to several sources, comes from the name of a Renaissance French insurrectionary dance. Harry Hay, Rudy Gerenreich, Chuck Rowland, and Bob Hull, as Linda Hirschman describes them, were three communists and one fashion icon, began to meet in private homes, complete with a daily worker strewn on the sofa. After 2 years, Mattachine had spread across the country. When one of its members, Dale Jennings, was arrested for public indecency after being entrapped by the police, the group decided to fight on his behalf. Hay convinced Jennings to have a jury trial, and they distributed thousands of leaflets reading, "Now is the time to fight. The issue is civil rights." The leaflet asked readers to ask themselves what they would do if facing a similar situation. Jennings' jury deadlocked, with only one juror thinking he was guilty, and Jennings was free. In the 3 days in court, Jennings had admitted openly to being a homosexual, and it was the first time that an admitted homosexual was exonerated of the charge of lewd conduct. The victory led to the further proliferation of the organization across California and in St. Louis, Chicago, and New York. At its beginning, Mattachine was focused on mass action and the mobilization of a large gay constituency who saw themselves as proud members of an oppressed class. Historian Linda Hirschman recounts an exchange between Hay and fellow Mattachine member Chuck Rowland. Rowland had attempted to become a communist, and he sympathized with the party's revolutionary goals. He said, "To most Americans, communists were wicked, horrid people, but the so-called liberals sat around and talked about socialized medicine, integration, and the rights of women. The communists, on the other hand, were out there on the barricades or picketing or closing something down, doing something, instead of just talking." However much Rowland appreciated the communists, though, he added, "Joining the Communist Party is very much like joining a monastery or becoming a priest. It is total dedication, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. I thought I wanted that, and I did for a while, but I realized I was having very little sex." Priorities, just saying. So, he told Harry, who had been expelled from the CP, longer story, "We'll just have an organization for gays." But Rowland and Hay were both frustrated. Harry Hay said, "What's our theory? We need a theory." And Harry said, "We're an oppressed cultural minority." And agreeing with Hay, Rowland said something to the effect that the other gays don't want to be an oppressed minority. They want to be like everyone else, except for what we do in bed. This debate over identity and difference was a current in the organization, and it is interesting to me that it was the communist theory, although not its practice, that embraced cultural difference. A member was disturbed by a Mattachine meeting announcing the topic, "What do we do with these effeminate queens," I'm sorry, this is a quotation, "effeminate queens and these stalking butches who are giving us a bad name." The member told historian Eric Marcus, "I got very angry at this attack, and I finally blurted out this story about the first time I went to a gay bar in 1943. The first view I got of my brothers and sisters was when about 12 drag queens and 12 butch numbers, I don't know what that means exactly, were led out of the bar by the police, and all of the butch numbers were looking guilty, and practically all of the queens were struggling and sassing the cops. I felt so good when I heard one of the queens scream at the policeman who was shoving her, 'Don't shove, you bastard, or I'll bite your fucking balls off.' That queen paid in blood." When I finished that story talking to the Mattachines, I said, "Look, the queens were the only ones who ever fought." But with the increased visibility on the movement, Hay's radical politics were under scrutiny. A layer of more conservative Mattachines saw him as a liability. Mattachine in California became more conservative. Breakaway chapters in New York and Washington, D.C. challenged the assimilationist factions in 1961. Frank Kameny, a D.C. member, shared Hay's revolutionary perspective. He and the organization fought his dismissal from the Army Map Service, but ultimately lost in the Supreme Court. He was the first openly gay person to testify before a congressional committee. He published an essay called The Homosexual Citizen, and with Randy Wicker formed the East Coast Homophile Organization, or ECHO. Mattachine also put out a magazine called One, starting in 1953. A lawsuit against One for salacious content was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the magazine in 1958. After the splits between the coasts, the East Coast groups organized a number of campaigns and actions. Alongside of this work, women were also organizing. The Daughters of Bilitis, named after a lover of the poet Sappho, followed a similar trajectory. Del Martin, one of the organization's founders, had just lost custody of her young daughter to her ex-husband because of her lesbianism. She and Phyllis Lyon, who became lovers, founded Daughters of Bilitis in 1955 in the Castro district of San Francisco to ameliorate their loneliness and sense of isolation. With five other women, they held a first house party inviting women who were seeking connection and self-understanding and an antidote to fear. Yet, as the decade came to close, the organization embraced political action. Martin wrote articles in the DOB's publication, The Ladder, to protest raids on gay bars and to promote the decriminalization of sodomy. The DOB took another turn toward the political when Barbara Geddings took the lead. With Kameny, Giddings urged an end to decorum and endless talk over and advocated action instead. So they organized pickets at courthouses where gays were being tried basically for the crime of existing. Thus, the homophile organizations were not the uniformly conservative and proper groups that were allegedly displaced by the militancy of the Stonewall era. To the contrary, these groups prepared the way for such militancy, building the confidence and consciousness of gays and lesbians who lived in constant fear of arrest, unemployment, the loss of family, and other forms of persecution. To exist in such spaces is automatically political. Without Mattachine and the Daughters of Bilitis, there may have not been a Stonewall to usher out the politics of respectability. Raids and persecutions continued into the 1960s, of course. However, the gay liberation movement was increasingly influenced by the anti-war movement, student movements, and civil rights movements, and alongside the budding gay liberation movement, feminist movements grew in numbers and confidence. A key figure in the civil rights movement was the gay leader Bayard Rustin, who organized the 1963 March on Washington and was Martin Luther King's right-hand man in the civil rights movement. Of continuing importance was mounting a challenge to the psychiatric stigmatization of homosexuality, and this emphasis was a characteristic of the Washington, D.C. chapter of Mattachine and the work of Frank Kameny, and I am skipping past this for the sake of time. Meanwhile, very interesting, universities increasingly became sites of struggle. In 1966, Columbia University student Bob Martin demanded that the university let the students found a homosexual club. Martin had been the first openly gay student admitted to Columbia. In response to administrative stonewalling, kind of pun intended, students occupied space in the basement of a dormitory. The protesters called their new gay lounge the Allen Ginsberg Center for the Rehabilitation of Straight People. At one point, a frustrated Morty Manford went into the dean's office and started taking furniture from the dean for their lounge. He also called the news network ABC. The administration gave in. A student activist recalled, "Something was happening. The lion was growing and learning. Columbia was teaching us something. It was teaching us to fight. It was teaching us not to be afraid." The work of Mattachine, the Daughters of Bilitis, psychiatric activists, and students had set the stage for the explosion that was Stonewall, which for many activists marks the official beginning of the queer liberation movement. The Stonewall Rebellion began on June 28, 1969, on Christopher Street in New York City at the Stonewall Inn, and it was a riot that was predated by militant sit-ins by gender, this is the word of the time, gender deviant youth and sex workers at Dewey's Restaurant, Cooper Donut, and Compton's Cafeteria. So that's the language of the news coverage. As in the case of Stonewall, restaurants and bars were sites of safety and organizing for queer people generally and trans people specifically. The Stonewall was a mafia-run bar that was routinely raided by police. That night, the queers who frequented the bar and its surrounds, including transvestites and street youth, rebelled against one of the raids, throwing bricks and coins at police who ultimately barricade themselves inside the bar, which subsequently was set on fire by protesters. There is a long history by Martin Duberman and several other histories that I will point you to because a lot of people already know the history of Stonewall. Again, for the point of the interest of time, I'm going to pass by some of that. But one thing that's really interesting is that the personal accounts of people who were there speak to a process of rapid radicalization that happens at such moments in history. Martin Boyce, a youth at the time, said, and I quote, "When it was over and some of us were sitting exhausted on the stoops, I thought, my God, we're going to pay so desperately for this. There was glass all over, but the next day we didn't pay. My father called and congratulated me. He said, 'What took you so long?' The next day we were out there again. We had had enough. Every queen in that riot changed." Queer Insurrectionists then published a manifesto to get cops out of bars, and Mattachine, however, reflecting its increasing irrelevance, posted notices calling for quiet conduct on the streets of Greenwich Village. After Stonewall, two major organizations formed. The first was the Gay Liberation Front, named in solidarity with the North Vietnamese National Liberation Front, signaling its radicalism. Martha Shelley, a member of Daughters of Bilitis, was frustrated with the group's growing quietude. Mattachine was also unsatisfying to her expanding political goals. So she, with others including Jim Ferrat, Bob Martin, Marty Robinson, and Arthur Evans, founded the Gay Liberation Front. They set a late July date for the march, which was the first political action after Stonewall. The march, rally, and celebration were openly militant and anti-capitalist. Following the example of black nationalists, the activists announced an agenda of gay power. Bob Martin told Eric Marcus, "What is gay power? It is demanding to be recognized as a powerful minority with just rights which have not been acknowledged. It is an insistence that homosexuality has made its own unique contribution to the building of our civilization and will continue to do so. And it is the realization that homosexuality, while morally and psychologically on a par with heterosexuality, does nonetheless have unique aspects which demand their own standards and their own subculture." This was among the first clear expressions of the idea that gays and lesbians wanted justice and equality, but also were crafting a separate culture and sense of identity. I think I missed the part about GLF naming themselves after the Viet Cong or North Vietnamese Army. Did I say it? Okay. All right. Say. Good. All right. So GLF's platform was wide-ranging. It called for free birth control. This is going to be important in a minute. 24-hour childcare, full employment for third world people and gays, elimination of the judicial system and the police, free food, shelter, transportation, healthcare, utilities, education, art, abolition of the bourgeois family, and the conversion of heterosexual radicals to homosexuality. Notoriously, the GLF held marathon meetings without rules or agendas at a space called Alternative U and organized in a cell structure. One cell was the openly communist Red Butterfly cell. GLF mounted a number of hit-and-run protests. They were plagued, however, by internal conflicts over whether they should be fighting for gay rights or in solidarity with others. For example, there was a fierce internal conflict over whether to support the homophobic Black Panther Party for self-defense, but who needed defending. So that's very interesting. Out of frustration with the chaos that was the GLF, the Gay Activist Alliance was founded by Arthur Evans and Marty Robinson, among others. You're going to hear people's names over and over again, like there's a chain of activism. The group became notorious for its unhip adoption of the Roberts Rules of Order in managing meetings with actual agendas. Martin Duberman argues that the GLF was the forerunner of radical groups like Queer Nation and ACT UP, whereas GAA, the Gay Activist Alliance, was the precursor to conservative and establishment-oriented groups like the Human Rights Coalition, the HRC. I believe that this is an unfair mischaracterization. As we all know, you can be organized and even use Robert's rules and be radical at the same time. In any case, the GAA invented the protest tactic called the ZAP, which we have seen in use in later movements in the 1980s ACT UP and in the 2000s by groups like Get Equal and in Black Lives Matter, in which an organized group of protesters gets access to events where politicians or celebrities are speaking and try to stage a confrontation. For example, the GAA targeted Mayor John Lindsay multiple times, trying to get him to acknowledge and respond to police raids and brutality. Robinson, Marty, said, "Our view was that it was very important to bring to the surface the deep down anger and resentment that gays had against the repressive policies of society. It was a process whereby gays would become aware of gay rights as a political issue, and it was part of the long process of achieving positive self-identification as gays and lesbians. I think time has proven that we did the right thing." Another member of GAA once said during that time period, "The only way of obtaining a meaningful response is to create a meaningful nuisance." One interesting point is that the GAA was the first that started using the term homophobia after Marty Manford was bashed and seriously injured by the president of the New York City Firemen's Union at a meeting of city bigwigs in 1972. The term homophobia was coined in this context by psychologist George Weinbert, who worked with Frank Kameny. The GAA activists appreciated the concept because it disputed who was mentally ill. Not the queers, but the haters. So I hope that you can see that GAA was not the ideological ancestor of the human rights campaign or of today's corporate pride events. Activists also moved across organizations depending upon their interests. Carla J., for example, describes going in the same week to GLF meetings and then feminist consciousness raising groups because the GLF male members were not woke about women's liberation and the feminist groups were anxious about lesbianism. But she said when you put the two together, you have something like a militant queer feminism. Those were not exactly her words. But anyway, in fact, the group Radical Lesbians emerged from Gay Liberation Front, joining Red Stockings and the New York Radical Feminists, among others, in the fight for women's liberation. Radical Lesbians published a manifesto called The Woman Identified Woman, which, among other things, stated, "What is a lesbian? A lesbian is the rage of all women condensed to the point of explosion." They famously zapped the Second Congress to Unite Women in New York and zapped them because the mainstream feminists had been denouncing lesbians as the lavender menace. A note here is about the radical feminists and their development of seriously transphobic and problematic ideas. Just an asterisk right there. So the energy of post-Stonewall radicalism carried activists into the 1970s. In the late 1970s, the success of activists in winning anti-discrimination bills at the local and state levels provoked a serious right-wing backlash and the rise of a hardened anti-gay right epitomized by the campaign led by singer Anita Bryant to undo those pieces of legislation and implement anti-gay referenda. Her efforts were successful in places where there were no powerful coalitions of experienced activists to mobilize a response. In California, such a coalition did defeat the Briggs Initiative, which would have barred gay and lesbian teachers from posts in the public schools. Where those coalitions were most effective is when the labor movement was involved. Miriam Frank's very interesting book, Out in the Union, documents the power that economic leverage can bring to queer struggles and how unions can benefit LGBTQ people by pushing for reforms like domestic partner benefits, health insurance that covers the needs of trans workers, anti-discrimination policy, and a mechanism to grieve these matters. Frank argues that the queer struggle is strengthened by the labor's capacity to reach beyond identity enclaves and that detachment from labor is a weakness when it comes to defeating the efforts of the right to roll back history. Of crucial importance in the resistance to Anita Bryant et al. Was the presence of an experienced intergenerational cadre whose political education dated back into the homophile movement. I'll come back to that. The 1970s also saw the rise of the powerful voices of black feminists like Barbara Smith and the Combahee River Collective. There's always more to say. Trans organizations carried on with organizing, responding to the insensitivity and hostility among queer liberations and feminists and organized with around the needs of trans women and particularly trans women of color. The Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, or STAR, was founded in 1970 by Sylvia Rivera, a prominent figure in the Stonewall Rebellion, and Marsha Johnson. STAR was both a political organization, but they also provided housing and other social services to homeless queer youth and sex workers in Manhattan. Youth organizations in high school also flourished through the decade as a new generation took the stage. Randy Schultz, who would become the author of And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic, came out in his high school anthropology class in 1972, having met former members of the GLF and the GEAA, which somehow were allowed into the school to give an assembly. Schultz commented, "In just 1 week, I was able to put the whole gay thing in perspective, to shift it from being my problem to being society's problem. Gee, I'm all right. It's society that's wrong." Over the course of time, both mainstream and alternative media and culture began to provide shifting images and narratives for gay Americans. The AIDS crisis interrupted this process. In the 1980s, gay militants were forced to turn their attention to demanding political and scientific response to the epidemic. Larry Kramer, along with several others, founded Gay Men's Health Crisis, a complex organization providing a range of services that exists to this day. asterisk debates between Kramer and the queer community. All right. There were also organizations and actions echoing the periods of militancy that came before. Marty Robinson, you know, remember him, founded the Lavender Hill Mob, which brought Zaps to the AIDS awareness movement. As a precursor to ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, they zapped St. Patrick's Cathedral. ACT UP zapped pharmaceutical companies and politicians. They zapped the New York Stock Exchange, chanting, "Release the drugs." They adopted the powerful and still resonant slogan, "Silence equals death," and appropriated the sign of the pink triangle to link the ravages of the epidemic, unaddressed by society at large, to the Holocaust. They published hundreds of flyers, zines, and statements. An act of civil disobedience on Wall Street demanded the establishment of an immediate, court-coordinated, comprehensive, and compassionate national policy on AIDS. The movement shifted from an emphasis on the do-it-yourself character of gay men's health crisis, which provided services for afflicted persons, to making demands on the establishment. Ultimately, there was a victory of sorts as federal institutions began to respond with research and treatment. But by 1988, 82,000 Americans had been diagnosed with AIDS and 46,000 of them died. Half of gay men in New York who were born between 1945 and 1960 were lost. Among these were Bob Martin. I'm sorry, I'm getting choked up. Not expecting that. Bob Martin, Marty Robinson, Jim Owls, Morty Manford, and Randy Schultz. In the context of such realities, it is difficult to claim victory for the movement that demanded recognition and treatment of AIDS. However, there is no doubt that the militancy and constant public pressure of ACT UP was instrumental in finally compelling national institutes and the pharmaceutical industry to respond to the crisis. And then there were the 1990s. An increasingly conservative Democratic Party overtook the gay liberation movement with money and politics-driven organizations like the HRC. The mainstream movement aligned itself with the neoliberal agenda, arguing for modest piecemeal reform and what critics now call homonormativity, the embrace of assimilation and conventional familial forms. The most glaring emblem of the Democratic Leadership Council strategy was, of course, Bill Clinton and his policy, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The 2000s were the decade of lawyers and laws when it came to progress for LGBTQ persons in the United States. The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force started a number of state-level efforts, and wealthy financier Tim Gill founded the Transgender Law and Policy Institute, and in general, there was a lot of attention to attempting to make change in the courts. The 1986 Bowers v. Hardwick decision of the Supreme Court upheld the criminalization of sodomy, but in 1996, Romer v. Evans upheld the protection of gays and lesbians under the Equal Protection Clause, nullifying an anti-gay law in Colorado. In 2003, Lawrence v. Texas decriminalized sodomy, and in 2009, we got a seriously misguided hate crimes law out of the Obama administration. And in 2011, Perry v. Schwarzenegger struck down another anti-gay amendment. So the 1990s and 2000s were decades of increased cultural visibility in mainstream, alternative, and social media. The 2008 election was an unprecedented historical moment, followed by the punch in the gut that was Proposition 8. And of course, the Obergefell decision in 2015 mandated marriage equality in all 50 states. And this was a monumental victory. Should be said that Obama was no friend of radical queer movements. Not only did he campaign with Joe Biden on the policy that marriage is between one man and one woman, from which he later evolved, but he also signed the Defense of Marriage Act that turned the law around marriage equality back to the states. And you know that argument about states' rights worked really well for black people during Jim Crow. Sarcasm. He invited right-wing evangelical Rick Warren to provide the blessing at his inauguration on the very eve of his addressing the Human Rights Commission banquet to pledge the support of gays and lesbians. This hypocrisy makes it clear that the electoralism and relying on the Democratic Party to liberate us are completely dead ends. Thus, marriage equality did not fall from on high as gifts from benevolent judges and politicians. Indeed, there was a liberatory wing to the marriage equality movement that resonates with memory of the Gay Activist Alliance. The organization Get Equal mobilized for normative reforms, including the inclusion of gays in the military and the right to marry. Yet in its tactics, Get Equal included the kind of zaps that the GAA pioneered. Acts of civil disobedience on the part of soldier Dan Choi brought national attention to these issues. Get Equal also supported the efforts of Chelsea Manning, the trans military whistleblower, combining the anti-war and queer liberation movements as she did. Most importantly, Get Equal and many other organizations, including the International Socialist Organization, built the 300,000-person-strong march in 2009 on Washington, the largest march on the Capitol to that date, and a watershed moment for our movement. Obergefell and marriage equality are the products of that activist moment. There are many more moments, organizations, and people that I could explore here, but I'd like to tie the stories of these compelling people and groups together with some significant lessons for our way forward toward more fully realized queer liberation. First, it is clear that liberation is a lifelong and intergenerational project. Queer liberation did not start in 1969 on Christopher Street. It was built out of organizations, efforts, publications, debates, splits, and experiences of all of the activists who came before. The homophile groups were incredibly brave and always political. Their members went on, inspired by the militancy of the late 1960s, to build new, excellent, and influential organizations, including ACT UP and Queer Nation. The subsequent generations, including you and me, are building upon that legacy. I'm missing a page or something. Okay. All right, so yeah, there it is. I cut things kind of willy-nilly to try to get to time. So what happened among GAAL and GLF and other organizations is that some of them, like Harry Hay, expected an identity-oriented movement like a gay rights movement to carry the weight of a revolutionary program. But the problem, it seems to me, is to expect a movement geared to benefit queer people exclusively to carry that weight. The groups and people were amazingly brave, creative, militant, organized, and successful, but they didn't have a theory. We need a theory that could sustain a broader revolutionary struggle. And I just quoted Harry Hay again. And he and Chuck Rowland were trying to get their heads around, what is our theory? A theory not only explains how oppressions operate, it also must explain how they are constitutive elements holding up a system, the system of capitalism. In GLF, the queers did not see themselves as an oppressed minority, did not generally see capitalism as the ground upon which oppressions thrive, did not think that they should pursue solidarity with a homophobic black nationalist movement, did not embrace feminism, and could not fathom the competing interests among members of a cross-class, multi-gender organization. They made themselves choose between revolution or reform, rather than seeing these dimensions of struggle to be part of a whole. But even in choosing revolutionary tactics, their politics were muddled for lack of a theory of totality in the place of gender and sexuality-based oppressions in it. So the only kind of queer liberation organization that will be revolutionary is one that understands and is responsive to the system as a whole. The International Socialist Organization understands queer oppression and all other oppressions in the context of how capitalism needs private families to carry the burden not only of biological reproduction, but also of social reproduction. In contemporary capitalism, housing, healthcare, education, socialization, housekeeping, and all the other functions that are laid at the doorstep of the private family are all made private responsibility such that capitalists and the state are off the hook when it comes to social reproduction. The ability of capitalism to privatize care work so ruthlessly depends upon an ideal of the private family. The GLF knew this, obviously, in their platform, free birth control, I'll just say it again, 24-hour childcare, full employment, elimination of the judicial system, free food, shelter, transportation, healthcare, utilities, education, and art, the abolition of the bourgeois family, and not incidentally, the conversion of heterosexual radicals to homosexuality. It's worth saying that again. But what is compelling really about that platform is recognizing that gay liberation, that queer liberation is connected to free birth control, childcare, employment, food, shelter, transportation, healthcare, utilities, education, and art. These are all things that capitalism privatizes and puts under the umbrella of the private family and lets us sink or swim when we are not able to actually carry that enormous burden of social reproduction. The social construction of gender roles is key to the justification that families, whatever their composition, must do all of the work in surviving an increasingly brutal system. Transgressing gender roles and the gender binary, as feminists and LGBTQ people do, threatens to undo this arrangement in reality and in popular consciousness, thereby alarming capitalists and the state, who profit from doing as little as possible of such labor as possible. Women's bodies and reproduction, along with trans and non-binary gender expression, are targeted for ideological and physical discipline. Thus, as socialists, we believe that intersectional oppressions of gender, sexuality, and race are interrelated on the terrain of capitalism. Oppression functions to divide groups from one another and uses identity categories in order to keep the privatization and exploitation machines functioning. This is our theory. Its logical conclusion is that we need a struggle against particular oppressions as part of an anti-capitalist struggle. In contrast to single-issue movements, we target the system as a whole. We are revolutionary socialists. In this historical moment, trans and genderqueer members of the ISO inspire us to become deeper on questions of identity, desire, psychology, and struggle. We must continue to develop a truly intersectional program that can explain how oppressions are connected to each other in the service of the imperatives of capitalism, and how the ideological and psychological dimensions of oppression are tied to economic exploitation. And finally, we need an organization that can weather the waves of militancy and defeat, one that can learn from backlash, one that can survive periods of retreat without surrender, complexity without dissolution, one that can build an intersectional and intergenerational project to end capitalism and replace it with something better. In struggle, there is hope. In revolutionary organization, in the ability to see the system as a whole and how to fight it, there is optimism and power. Thank you.